Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 154 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, novelist Diana Evans takes us to a writer's retreat in upstate New York, where she considers how race is a theme that seems imposed on black writers, obligating them to rage against racial injustice. Her characters, she says, have the right to be human first, to be ordinary. Following Diana, novelist Conan Jones considers place and authenticity in the storytelling process. Risk being unique or aim for palatable? That's the choice in writing, as in winemaking. First up, here's Diana Evans with Retreat to Hudson.
I am on the Amtrak from Penn Station to Hudson, NY. It's October, pre-Trump, post-referendum. The Hudson River is to my right, a beautiful liquid sheet stretching across to the green and cobber hills on the other side, from which a mist is rising. It surprises me how close the train tracks are to the water, how close we run by it. It's right there at my window, this silver vastness like an ocean, the trees rushing by along the bank, reeds sticking out through the surface, and above it all a soft autumnal sky of late afternoon, turning towards dusk, the sun muted by clouds. I'm on my way to a writer's retreat in upstate New York, where I'll stay for 2 weeks, during which I hope to finish a novel I have been working on for some time. The retreat is called Writer's Omai and is set in 300 acres of countryside overlooking the Catskill Mountains next to a sculpture park, which is also a feature of Omai. They offer residencies in architecture, music, art and dance as well. During my stay, it will be writers and translators only, 10 of us in total, some American, some, like me, from other countries, all of us united in our commitment to the written word, anticipate an absolute submersion in its deep challenges and agonies, away from the demands of daily life. But I've packed for this trip reluctantly. I recently moved house and finally have my very own loft room in London in which to write, my ideal writing location, secluded and close to the sky. Why, I wonder, am I travelling 300 miles away to write somewhere else? Sitting opposite me on the train are two American women of a certain age, possibly sisters, wearing knee-length dresses and flat shoes. They have dried, papery complexions and dyed blonde hair. They're chatting away and sharing pictures on their phones, sighing, smiling to themselves. Maybe they're on their way back to the suburbs after a day out in the city. When someone in the carriage sneezes, one of them says, "God bless you." The other plays with the wrinkled flesh on her knees and puts her feet up on the chair next to me. Their presence, their oblivious physical ease, is an invasion into the book I'm reading, African-American author Ta-Nehisi Coates' New York Times bestseller, Between the World and Me, which I started at Heathrow Airport at dawn. It has completely arrested me. A long essay written in the style of a letter to the author's teenage son, it encapsulates the big delusion of race while describing what it's like to live inside its confines. Black people are black, Coates argues, only because white people have been led to believe that they are white. Race is the child of racism, he writes, not the father. In the novel I want to finish at Omai, I'm trying, as I often do, to get away from the theme of race. I find it reductive. It's a theme that seems imposed on black writers, obligating them to rage against racial injustice, to enlighten everyone on their experiences pertaining to race. I'm more interested in my novel in writing about marriage and motherhood, London, friendship, about how our identities change as we grow older and the struggle we go through to accept our new selves. The theme of race is implicit in all of this because it's implicit in the lives of my characters, but they're human first. They have the right to be human first, to be ordinary. And reading Coates's book reminds me of this imperative, makes me feel spurred and encouraged in my work. Writing and reading is a conversation, and I often feel that I'm writing in response to things I read, as a gesture towards them, or indeed away from them. I would like my characters to be perceived, at least in racial terms, as ordinary, their skin colour as commonplace as these two ladies sitting in front of me. As we pull out of Newburgh Station onwards to Poughkeepsie, the sun moves out over the Hudson, freed from the clouds. It makes a glittering stage of gold on the water, and the copper hills glow brighter. Someone is swimming out there in the middle, going in the opposite direction from the train. Someone else is fishing, a black silhouette looking out at the water, waiting. Nobody at the retreat thinks Trump will win. Every evening at 7 o'clock, we sit around the long rustic dining table in the main house and have dinner together, cooked by a wonderful chef. At lunch and breakfast, we're free to help ourselves to the contents of the fridge and kitchen cupboards, and if there's anything we need, like soy milk or mushroom pate or a particular flavour of potato chip, we're encouraged to write it down on the shopping list. Our rooms and bathrooms are clean for us. All we have to do is write. There's a Finnish novelist, a French translator, a Catalan poet, a Berkeley academic, a librarian from Cleveland writing stories about taboos. No way will he win, the Americans assume. It's impossible. Hillary will be president, not Donald. It's that same complacency that soothed the nerves of the Remain voters during the Brexit referendum. That's exactly what I thought, I say to them, but look what happened. It's strange and also a little strenuous having dinner with these people, these strangers, every night. In my normal life, I limit social occasions to no more than twice a week. Too much conversation makes me feel scattered inside, as if I can no longer hear my own thoughts. I worry that it will make me lose the channel to my writing. So I walk over to the main house in the evening darkness, again with reluctance. There is always wine, though. There's baseball on TV in front of the fire. It's the World Series. The Chicago Cubs are playing the Cleveland Indians. And although I long for home, where all my books and folders are, where there is a sense of permanence, actually, this is a very special kind of holiday, to be surrounded by other writers in an environment that is designed to support us. During those long postprandial conversations around the dining table, we have title consultations and difficult chapter sessions. We air problems in our work that we can't seem to solve on our own. One night, we conduct an experiment where I read out a poem by the Catalan poet in English at the same time as she recites it in the original Catalan. She's trying to work out the best way of performing her poem to the English-speaking audience who will be at our group reading in New York City, planned for the following weekend. After dinner, I walk back to the neighbouring house in the deeper night dark. It's so cold, tomorrow there'll be snow. I miss the loft, I miss my family. My room here, funnily enough, has something of the loft about it. It's on two floors, a desk and a bed on the lower floor, then up a small flight of stairs to a little bed and wardrobe beneath a sloping attic roof. That's where I sleep, long, bottomless sleeps interrupted not by children, just by dawn light in the attic window. On a writer's retreat, you can be single again if you're married. You can be childless if you're a parent. You're free. I wake up and go for runs in the woods and through the sculpture park, listening to my iPod. The sculptures are dotted around the fields, some of them huge, with plaques on the ground next to them bearing the artist's name. At the top of a wide hill, there is a spinning house, mounted on a single supporting pole. And if you can reach high enough, you can send it spinning with a big push. At the edge of this field, looking towards the spinning house, is a giant wooden chair set in an arched shade. I climb up its rungs, like climbing a ladder, and sit down, thinking about Coates's son, the moment in the book when he learns that the killer of Michael Brown, a black American shot by a police officer in 2014, would not be punished. I've got to go, the boy says, and goes upstairs to his room to cry. Black people love their children with a kind of obsession, Coates writes. You are all we have, and you come to us endangered. I stopped reading this passage on the flight coming into JFK because I didn't want to weep on a middle seat on an aeroplane. Coates's voice strikes with such simplicity right at the heart of the universal pain caused by the construction of race. And reading it at this time, just after the shock and dismay of the referendum result, and during Trump's helplessly prejudiced campaign, makes it all the more powerful. By the lake, which is almost frozen from the cold, there is another house made by another of the architecture residents. It's actually on the lake, sitting on the water, at the end of a path beginning at the bank. This is my favourite piece. The walls are transparent. There are suggestions of domestic life, a platform covered by a blanket for a bed, a little table and chair, and a kitchen hob. It's art, uninhabitable, but I love to sit down on the hard bed and watch the lake, to be this close to the water, and so static there, not adrift as in a boat, or racing like the Amtrak, but still, rooted. It's a kind of apparition of home, a symbol of my absence from my own home. I imagine apparitions of my family moving around me, myself sitting at the table writing. We are indifferent to the outside world, engulfed in the serenity of the lake and the surrounding woods. While not too far away, in a neighbouring town, there is an effigy of Hillary Clinton parading on the roof of someone's house. There are Trump-Pence signs on the grassy banks along upstate highways, signs of what's to come. The skewed democracy that's about to make this man president. Whenever I go on a retreat, I always get lots of writing done, more than usual. I work extra hard to justify the luxury of time. I write all day. I sit at the desk before the window that looks out on the main house and the fields and write. When the snow comes, it makes it easy to stay in my chair. I get to the end of the book, and it's a good end. The kind of end I'd been hoping for. The endings of books are full of anxiety. Will you find the right words? Will you tie the loose ends? Will you leave the right feeling? Or will you disappoint yourself? But the right words come sailing in and flow out onto my page, dancing, and I'm exhilarated. I don't know whether the same words would have come if I'd been in my other loft back home. They seem conjured by the house on the lake and the giant seat, and by Coates's voice echoing in my head, by my very distance from home in this vastness of America and my insignificance within it. I have forgotten myself, making room for more. As planned, my first ever New York City reading takes place at the KGB bar in the East Village. Apparently, according to a Paris Review columnist and substantiated by one of the barmen, the place is haunted. The ghosts live in the mirror behind the bar. The walls are a dark bloody red and the lighting is so dim we have to huddle over our pages to read. The audience is small, consisting mainly of friends of the writers. I don't read the poem with the Catalan poet as per our experiment. Instead, she reads it herself, alone, gesticulating with her arms and hands. I read a scene from my novel, its first public outing. Then, a few days later, I come back to the city, back along the Hudson River on the Amtrak to Penn Station, and take the subway to JFK. I wait there for my flight, homeward bound, back to the confines of my real life, with the finished novel in my suitcase.
That was Diana Evans, recorded by Francis Burns. You can find out more about Diana on the RLF website. Next, here's Conan Jones with Terroir.
Early January. There's winter sun, and I take a walk along the cliff path north. Some mile or so up the coast, the cliffs drop to beach level. The sun is pale, translucent, and a mist hangs over the water in the bay. The tide is at its lip, turning to ebb, sliding from the mist, the sound of breaking waves enveloping, calm and still. As I stand and take a breath, a boat comes from the fret. Two men, in rags, rowing. They have an urgent look to them, hunted. It doesn't really happen, of course, but I see it. The men row, as if escaping something, drive the boat into the shore with the sound of a shovel going into gravel. I don't make a formal note or rush to write this down. The image persists with a feeling of solid reality as something I have truly seen, and the trailing tales behind the image witter back into conversation with all my similar scenarios, connect with other possibilities. I leave them in their mutterings and walk on. This is how it tends to happen for me, things seen, as it were, bedding into the imagination, where, almost without notice, they wait, contribute and combine while a wider story forms and hovers until I'm ready to approach it, or itself becomes impatient, that story, stands upon its own two feet and demands I pay attention. American novelist Orson Scott Card suggests everybody walks past 1,000 story ideas every day. The good writers are the ones who see 5 or 6 of them. Most people don't see any. If you are someone who does see them, you can either choose to chase those ideas down or set yourself in a likely place and wait for them to approach. Where you wait very much determines what sort of an idea might appear. You might wait in a cafe in Edinburgh, or a street market in Camden, or an airport lounge in Tokyo. But I'm primarily fired by the landscape, or rather, by what being in that landscape provokes. I am more the birdwatcher sitting still to see what comes along than the twitcher deliberately collecting sightings, seeing what possibilities the setting suggests, what questions, what if I found a boat washed up, what if I went out in a kayak and was hit by lightning, what if I came across men digging up a badger set. Essentially, what if? Tell me you've never dreamed of finding buried treasure. It's a make-believe, like childhood. Stories happening this way, happening to me, in a way, while going about the business of life, has made it difficult to answer the almost invariably asked question, where do you get your inspiration? I don't go and get it. It just, well, the stories are just out there. Even the often you'd get instead of find misunderstands the exercise. The question should not be, in the face of so many ideas, where do you get your inspiration? Because stories, as Card noted, are frankly everywhere. The question, rather, should be, why do we choose to write the stories that we choose to write? Are we, like a tree bent a certain way by prevalent winds, shaped by the primary forces around us? Are we, this way, angled towards certain things, perhaps away from others? Or is it more subtle than that? Are we less able to choose stories than we know? Do we simply suit some things more than others because of our makeup, our upbringing, our background? As the Orcadian writer George Mackay Brown recognised, it is in childhood that a poet is summoned. In childhood, when we're less conscious of what we're trying to be and more simply conscious of what we are. Is there something inside us, way back buried in our DNA, if you will, that attracts us to certain narratives? Some underlying thing metalled way back in our ancestry? Are Celts more drawn to stories set strongly into a place? Are Anglo-Saxons more drawn to tales of material gain and power? Does that something in us even have some say in the very words we choose to tell our stories with, the rhythms with which we set them out? I spent years working in the wine industry, and one of the key elements in any wine is terroir. Terroir, from the Latin territorium, means land. But here, it's more than that, defined beautifully as the complete natural environment in which a particular wine is produced. Factors such as soil type, the way a slope faces in relation to the sun, climate, morning fogs, proximity to the sea, everything counts. Terroir is integral to good wine, and the endeavour is to let it be expressed, not to mask it. The same winemaker can grow the same vines the same way in vineyards only a few miles apart, and the resulting wine will be different, particularly if the vine has been established in that place for some time, with deeper roots, drawing up more of the elements that make up terroir through into the fruit. A chalky minerality, a briny echo of prehistoric seashells mistled in the soil, Chablis. A nose like wet shale on a beach, the blue slate soil of Moselle. Classic wines are classic because they are innately linked to place. They cannot be made anywhere else. It might be a nuance in the flavour, a texture, a faint bias. It's not necessarily overt, but it's absolutely tangible. Can a writer, then, have terroir? And should this be what we use when it comes to deciding which stories we should tell and which we should leave to others. A Hungarian winemaker who rips up their Haslevelu wines and replants with Chardonnay might make a reasonable Chardonnay and, while consumers are gulping Chardonnay, might meanwhile make a reasonable buck. But consumers will eventually want Pinot Gris instead, Sauvignon Blanc or Albarino. What does the winemaker do then? The winemaker might, of course, produce a highly successful Chardonnay with its own remarkable expression. But somebody has to take on the curating of the native, the thing unique to a place, product of a place, irretrievably connected with a place, or wines will end up aiming to taste the same, to be what is more popularly consumed. Risk being unique or aim for palatable, that's the choice, in writing as in winemaking, and one that plays a strong part when deciding which stories we should or shouldn't write. In my process, a story certainly grows. It needs time to gestate, to form. Surely, as it does, it takes things of me on. If I try to write a story that I shouldn't, it does not thrive. It cannot find the nutrients it needs. I am the wrong soil for it. I did go through a stage early on when I started writing of trying to generate ideas more deliberately, often chasing things I wasn't comfortable with or didn't know about, and often chasing them away, perhaps. But the stories didn't click, didn't hold together properly. The 5th century Greek philosopher Empedocles believed that living things were first created when disembodied organs came randomly together through the power of attraction. Things floated in some primordial soup. If things came together in unfit combinations, the creature did not survive. An animal with the head of a cow, the tail of a fish, and the wings of a bird would fail. But if the right parts connected, the resulting creature lived. The head of a cow, the tail of a cow, the legs of a cow. So it is, I think, with stories. But that primordial soup is as vital as the objects. I am better now at putting myself in the right place where the stories I want to tell are more likely to appear. I'm also better at recognizing when a story isn't viable. The things we note, that we are naturally drawn to, that enter our mind and float there with everything else we are, as I said, witter together, form relationships, until a thing is created itself and demands, as Shakespeare's Theseus would have it, that our pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. If that story comes forth imbued with individuality, with local specificity, with something unique bound up within its very material, it is more compelling, has the thing of good strong writing, the unique stamp, the inner light Ted Hughes warns can all too easily be lost, particularly in a world where publishers increasingly look to publish books like those already proved successful. When you've written a few, you understand. You can't embark on a story naively, without proper concern for it. There is a point of commitment, and that commitment has to be utter for the story to be strong. We, our mind, character, moods, are the ground a story grows from, and only some ideas can really flourish in us. Let them witter together. Give them time, and there will be a point when you feel something new, something become, a change. No longer are the external things, the sparks, the details, the cameos, the anecdotes, the things of inspiration. The story now is the thing. The story is the inspiration.
That was Conan Jones, recorded by James McConaughey. You can find out more about Conan on his website at www.conanjones.com. That's Conan, spelt C-Y-N-A-N. And that concludes episode 154, which was produced by Conan McPhee. Coming up in episode 155, in the second installment of an ongoing series, 6 RLF writers share their all-time favourite book with us and explain why it matters. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.